on WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Jackson Rothman with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, April 24th. Sarasota school board candidate Teresa DeWitt got statewide attention yesterday, the unwelcome kind. In a column about Bridget Ziegler on the Florida Politics News site, political analyst Peter Schorsch pointed at low polling numbers for the Moms for Liberty co-founder and controversial school board chair. He described Ziegler's style as a, quote, political brand voters have rejected, and predicted her influence will lead to a liberal school board majority after the August election. He suggests Ziegler pick Teresa DeWitt, a former co-chair of Moms for Liberty, as her successor. He described DeWitt as an unserious contender who will cannibalize conservative votes from fellow Republican candidate Heidi Brandt. Schorsch, quote, at this point, the question is no longer whether Bridget Ziegler is toxic. The question is why Teresa DeWitt thought building a candidacy around that toxicity was ever a winning idea, unquote. In an interview with WSLR this week, DeWitt partially distanced herself from Ziegler's policies and described the Sarasota chapter of Moms for Liberty as inactive. We asked her for comment on Schorsch's column, and we are airing a profile of the candidate on tonight's newscast at 6. After weeks of delays, Florida's legislative leaders announced Thursday that they reached an agreement on an outline for a state budget for the next fiscal year and for a start of a special session to pass that budget. Florida House and Senate leaders said that they have agreed to spend about $52 billion in general revenue dollars in the next fiscal year on the state's priorities. Although House and Senate Republican leaders claim that the spending agreement will yield a smaller budget, the agreed-to $52 billion in general revenue spending exceeds the near $50.6 billion in the current year's budget. State lawmakers agreed to return to Tallahassee May 12th through 29th for a special session to work out the details and craft the final 2026-27 fiscal year budget. This Monday, April 27th, a special magistrate will hear an appeal by D.R. Horton. The national home builder will argue the Sarasota County Commission's denial of a rezoning petition that would have allowed the Texas-based company to build 126 homes near a bird preserve at the celery fields was unlawful. The hearing was brought on after D.R. Horton filed a motion under a Florida appeal mechanism for developers, stating the county commission had failed to provide adequate reasons for its unanimous denial of the rezone of Smith Family Farm last year. The company also argues the denial unfairly burdened the landowner's property rights. The Sarasota Audubon Society, a local wildlife conservation organization, says that, quote, any development at this location risks the safety and well-being of visitors of the park and surrounding residents, as well as jeopardizing the wildlife that the community and tourists from around the world come to enjoy, unquote. This has been Jackson Rothman with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, April 24th.
The program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini, and thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. A belated thanks to all who contributed to this station and this show during the Giving Challenge. In case you haven't heard, the station achieved its goal for unique donations that earned the matching funds from the Patterson Foundation. Well done. Just when it seemed the world could not become any more corrupt, now we have online platforms to take bets on literally anything, which may not seem like that serious, until, at least in the beginning of these schemes, players in the game being wagered on could participate. Recently, Kalshi, one of two big providers of the service, suspended betting by three politicians for committing political insider trading, who bet on themselves to prevail in primary contests. All these prediction markets are compared to commodity futures markets. The kinds of things that can be in play include basically everything and anything, not just fluctuations in supplies or values of real products. The danger, as we may have already seen, is not from people like candidates or athletes who are easily identified, but folks who have the ability to subtly alter events. Whoever thought that the Orange Menace would close a Truth Social rant proclaiming praise to Allah? I wonder how much somebody made on that deal. Stay tuned until half past the hour to hear my conversation with Brian Boyle, Chief Program Officer and General Counsel for American Promise, an organization working to pass a constitutional amendment to get money out of politics. But first, hear how the legislature wants to cut kid care. The DeSantis administration is getting pushback for its children's health care policies and its decision to remove tens of thousands of children from a subsidized health insurance program. During a joint Legislative Budget Commission meeting held last week, Medicare Director Brian Meyer said enrollment in the Florida kid care program was lower than what the state's top economists had predicted. That led to a recommendation to sweep $32 million from the program and redirect it to the state's general revenue fund. The legislative panel authorized to make spending decisions while the legislature is not in session voted to sweep the money from the low-cost health insurance program, but the vote was not unanimous and it follows concerns raised by a bipartisan group of legislators. I'm really disappointed, and I'd like to see the Agency for Healthcare actually help the people of the state of Florida who are struggling with having to insure their children, to give their children health insurance. And I find this whole thing very troubling, said Senator Lori Berman, a Democrat from Boca Raton, who opposed the $32 million sweep. Specifically, Maya was asked about the DeSantis administration decision to defy a federal law that requires the state to keep children enrolled for up to 12 months in the federal Children's Health Insurance Program, which operates in the state under the Florida Kid Care moniker, even if their parents don't pay monthly premiums, which range between $15 and $20 a month. The DeSantis administration challenged a policy in federal court, arguing the continuous eligibility requirements runs afoul of a state law requiring families to contribute to the cost of coverage, and moreover, the premiums are a vital financing component for the program, and it disenrolled tens of thousands of children whose families didn't pay premiums. While the state dropped its legal challenges in February, Meyer said conversations between the state and Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services over the policy continue. As recently as last week, I've had conversations with CMS about this, so we are actively trying to get an agreeable place between both parties so we can move this program, Meyer said. Berman was asked whether the state continues to disenroll children. Meyer said, "I believe that is the case." Florida Kid Care is an optional Medicaid expansion for children whose families earn too much to qualify for the traditional Medicaid program. It is the state's version of the federal Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, passed by Congress in 1997. The federal government pays about 69 cents of every dollar. The rest is funded through a combination of state funds and family premiums. The dispute between the DeSantis administration and the federal government over the continuous eligibility requirement goes beyond whether children should remain eligible for coverage when premiums aren't paid. It has also prevented the state from moving ahead with implementing a 2023 law championed by former House Speaker and Republican gubernatorial hopeful Paul Renner, passed unanimously in the Florida legislature. HB 121 boosted the maximum qualifying family income from 200% to 300% of the federal poverty level. 2026, that difference between earning $66,000 annually for a family of four versus $99,000 annually. An estimated 442,000 uninsured children were estimated to benefit from the change. The state needed to approval from CMS to increase the income limit, which it received in December 2024. But the approval came with a caveat that the state abide by the continuous eligibility requirements. Court-ordered payback of illegal tariffs is set to begin. But who will get the money? The Trump administration has officially begun the process of repaying up to $175 billion in illegally collected tariffs following a February Supreme Court ruling. It's the biggest such repayment program in history, and over 330,000 businesses stand to benefit. But American consumers, that is, the people who ended up shouldering the higher prices thanks to these fees, likely won't see the cash anytime soon. Justin Wolfers, a professor of economics at the University of Michigan, told Mother Jones the tariffs, a vast set of taxes Trump imposed on imports, haven't achieved what they were meant to achieve. They were meant to onshore manufacturing. It's continued to shrink. They were meant to lead new factories being built. That hasn't happened. They were meant to lead to an increase in government revenue, but the government is about to write a whole bunch of checks. They were meant to lead to the U.S. having leverage and signing new trade deals. We have effectively done none of that. So, at the minimum, it's achieved nothing positive. The refunds that might seem like a step towards minimizing the economic damage of Liberation Day. But Wolfers said that it's not how he'd put it in his Economics 101 class. Often the economics that we do is we'll try to subsidize something that we want more of, or we'll try to tax something that we want less of, a basic incentive structure. These tariff refunds don't incentivize much because they're purely tied to what you did in the past, which means companies have no incentive to do anything. This is more like when your grandma sends you money for your birthday, he said. Smaller companies that folded entirely on the onset of the Trump's tariffs, think women selling handmade earrings on Etsy from their living rooms, won't be refunded. Consumers, too, will likely miss out. In February, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent told reporters at the Economic Club in Dallas, "I've got a feeling the American people won't see the money. My sense is this could be dragged out for weeks, months, years, so we'll see what happens there," Bessent added. So, nothing here has helped American consumers, Wolfers said. If Costco raised the price of olive oil, I paid that higher price, and now I'm poorer. Costco now gets a refund. So, what we did is we took the money out of the government coffers and give it to Costco. Costco is not going to write me a check. It has no reason to. And now that there's less money in the government coffers, so eventually they're going to have to tax me some more. Theoretically, shoppers could benefit from the lower prices after the tariff, but Budget Lab at Yale suggests that's not the case, and the corporations haven't stopped passing costs on to consumers. One group of Costco shoppers is attempting to sue the supermarket chain for collecting tariff prices from consumers while simultaneously seeking refunds of the same tariff payments from the federal government, so they'd be repaid by the government for the cost that they've already passed on to shoppers. Costco stands to recover on the same tariff payment twice. If the court doesn't intervene, the customers wrote in their complaint, as of April 9th, over 56,000 importers had already completed the necessary steps to get an electronic refund, but they aren't required to pass any of that money on to consumers. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. New rules in New York City may cost the grifter-in-chief higher taxes on his penthouse. He once valued is the most expensive in the world. President Donald Trump has been outspoken in his disapproval of the proposed pied-à-terre tax in New York City, backed by Mayor Zoran Mamdani and New York Governor Kathy Hochul. While he has framed his complaint as solely an objection to taxes in general, it is possible that he has a little more personal concern. His own penthouse in Trump Tower could be subject to the levy. Hochul's proposal, which may make it into the state budget currently under discussion in state legislature, would assess a tax on homes worth more than $5 million that do not serve as a primary residence. Trump's 11,000-square-foot condo on Manhattan's famed Fifth Avenue is easily worth more than that, although by how much is a matter of some debate. During the 2023 civil trial for allegedly defrauding leaders by inflating the value of Trump's assets to get better loan terms, it emerged that the Trump Organization's financial statements between 2012 and 2016 claimed the apartment was larger than 30,000 square feet and valued it at up to $327 million. The judge found that was an overstatement by between $114 million and $207 million. Trump's current primary residence is the White House. Even when he's out of office, he no longer used Trump Tower as his primary residence, having moved his legal permanent residence in 2019 to his Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach, Florida. During his first term in 2018, Trump attempted to claim a $48,000 property tax abatement on the New York penthouse that applies only to one's permanent residence, but the city rejected that on the grounds that he lived in the White House at the time. Hochul has not specified the tax rates, but they're expected to increase at higher values and be designed to raise $500 million per year. Under the original pied-à-terre tax proposed in 2019, units worth more than $25 million would be taxed at 4% of their value. Trump could avoid being hit with the tax if he or a family member made it their primary domicile, or if he rented it out to someone else who does. City Hall did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The White House referred questions to the Trump Administration organization, which did not immediately respond. Despite his warm interactions with Mamdani at the White House, Trump inveigled against the tax on April 16th. Sadly, Mayor Mamdani is destroying New York. It has no chance, Trump wrote on Truth Social. The United States of America should not contribute to its failure. It will only get worse. The tax policies are so wrong, people are fleeing. They must change their ways and fast. History has proven this stuff just doesn't work. Thank you for your attention to this matter, President DJT. Mamdani responded in a more sober tone on April 17th. The president and I both want the city to succeed, the mayor said during a news conference. This is how you do it. I made it clear to the president and to the public that I am deeply supportive of taxing the rich, he added. The city press release from April 15th noted that the measure targets ultra-wealthy, out-of-city residents and global elites who use New York City real estate as a vehicle for wealth storage rather than homes. Some states are considering criminalizing abortion for the patient. The mask is off. After years of insisting they'd never punish women, one of the nation's leading anti-abortion groups has unceremoniously endorsed legislation to imprison abortion patients. Last week, Students for Life President Christian Hawks celebrated SB 1095 in South Carolina, a bill that would jail abortion providers, funders, helpers, and patients. The group's press release notably leaves out that last part. Under the Unborn Child Protection Act, women who have abortions would be punished on misdemeanor criminal charges. Even rape victims and those with non-viable pregnancies would face 2 years in prison time for having an abortion. Still, Hawks says, this should be an easy vote. The endorsement marks the biggest shift in anti-abortion politics in decades and leaves Republicans with a difficult choice ahead of the midterms. Do they align themselves with a movement explicitly calling for the punishment of women? Because, let's be clear, while Students for Life is radical, they don't operate on the fringes. They're one of the movement's largest organizing machines with more than 1,500 campus chapters in all 50 states. The group works closely with state and federal lawmakers and has helped craft model legislation across the country. As extreme as SFL is, they want to outlaw birth control and claim Americans are drinking abortions. They're also powerhouse policy players. They are the anti-abortion movement's mainstream. The last few weeks have made it unmistakable. Pregnancy-related arrests are soaring, even without laws that explicitly punish women. Equal protection legislation to prosecute patients as murderers has been on the rise, with over a dozen states considering such bills over the past year. The so-called abortion abolitionists who craft and lobby for these bills, which could mean life in prison or the death penalty, are also becoming more mainstream. The men behind the movement are writing op-eds, speaking at Turning Point USA events, even being elected to office. Just a few weeks ago, Abortion Every Day discovered that Heartbeat International, the largest crisis pregnancy network in the country, had aligned themselves with an abolitionist group. And while Hawkins and SFL have publicly squabbled with abolitionists in the past, it seems like there's increasing overlap of their strategies. After all, it was SFL's January conference where activist Abby Johnson launched her Make Abortion Murder Again campaign, calling for women to end their pregnancies to face homicide charges. In the South Carolina legislation, SFL is directing their followers to support. That started as an equal protection bill. SB 323 failed to pass because Senator Richard Cash couldn't get enough South Carolina Republicans on board with giving women the death penalty. SB 1095 is his version of a compromise bill he hopes will be more palatable because it only charges abortion patients with a misdemeanor. For anti-abortion groups, the tactic seems to be working. Pro-life Greenville opposed SB 323 last year, but is endorsing SB 1095. SC Citizens for Life also opposed SB 323, but has been silent on the bill's latest iteration. Here's the thing. Whether it's for 2 years or a lifetime in prison for abortion is still prison. And anti-abortion leaders are never going to be able to get voters on board. Even Hawkins herself knows that. She told the Associated Press last year, if you want more pro-abortion Democrats to win future elections, then keep talking about putting women in jail by all means. So what's changed? Maybe Hawkins thinks the culture has shifted enough to openly call for punishing patients. More likely, SFL believes they can float a trial balloon without anyone noticing. It's certainly not a coincidence that their press release doesn't mention what the bill would do to women. Election watchdogs are challenging administration attempts to rig the midterms. Voting rights activists accused the Trump Organization in a lawsuit this week of laying the groundwork for voter purges. It could illegally remove eligible voters ahead of a tightly contested U.S. midterm elections in November. The lawsuit asked a Washington, D.C. federal judge to bar the Department of Justice from accessing or using states' lists of registered voters and to delete data it had already obtained. It was filed by lawyers with the American Civil Liberties Union, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, and the Project Democracy and the Protect Democracy Project. The lawsuit alleges that President Donald Trump's effort to expand the government's role in elections ahead of the midterms, when the Republican Party is locked in a tight battle to maintain control of both houses of Congress. The U.S. Constitution says elections must be administered by individual states, and 18 states have already agreed or signaled plans to share voter data with the department. Critics say the Republicans' push to control voter rolls is driven less by election security than by false fraud claims and an effort to gain political advantage by narrowing the electorate, risking the disenfranchisement of eligible, often Democratic-leaning voters. The U.S. Department of Justice has launched an illegal and unprecedented quest to stockpile millions of Americans' confidential voter data, the complaint reads, alleging that the agency is building a sprawling new voter surveillance and purging apparatus without congressional authorization. The Justice Department did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Its lawyers have said the agency has authority to ensure states are doing enough to keep ineligible people off the rolls. Beginning last year, the Justice Department asked states to provide unredacted copies of their voter rolls, including driver's license numbers and partial Social Security numbers. In an interview with Fox News' Sunday Morning Futures program, Assistant Attorney General Harmeen Dillon said that the department had reviewed 60 million voter records so far and found the names of 350,000 dead persons and 25,000 people who lacked proof of citizenship. Dillon, who leads the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, did not provide any evidence that votes were cast for those names. The Justice Department has sued 30 states which have resisted handing over their rolls, as well as Washington, D.C. Federal judges in five states have dismissed those lawsuits, finding the department failed to justify its demands. Tuesday's lawsuit is separate from those cases. The new lawsuit argues DOJ plans to use the data to direct states to remove voters based on flawed verification methods, risking false positives that would wrongly purge eligible citizens. DOJ is investigating the Southern Poverty Law Center's efforts to infiltrate white supremacist organizations. Justice Department is investigating the Southern Poverty Law Center in connection with a now-defunct program that used paid confidential informants to infiltrate white supremacists and other groups, according to a video posted by the nonprofit and sources with direct knowledge of the matter. The case is being spearheaded by U.S. Attorney's Office for the Middle District of Alabama, the sources said. Southern Poverty Law Center is a nonprofit that tracks white supremacists and other hate groups across America and has been a frequent target of President Trump's allies. In the video posted this week, CEO Brian Fair said the probe focuses on bringing potential charges against both the organization and possibly individuals connected to the group. The focus appears to be on the SPLC's prior use of paid confidential informants to gather credible intelligence on extremely violent groups, he said. The use of informants was necessary because we are no stranger to threats of violence. In 1983, our offices were firebombed, and in the years since, there have been countless credible threats against our staff, he said. For decades, we engaged in unprecedented litigation to dismantle the Klan and other hate groups. In light of that work, we sought to protect the safety of our staff and public. We frequently shared what we learned from informants with local and federal enforcement, including the FBI. the probe comes just as the Justice Department has stepped up its scrutiny of nonprofits that it accuses of being involved in funding domestic terrorism. It was not clear if the criminal investigation is related to the to that initiative, and a spokesperson for the Southern Poverty Law Center did not know the Justice Department's legal theory behind the probe. CBS News has reached out to the Justice Department for comment. You're listening to WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPV, LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Stay tuned to hear my interview with Brian Boyle, Chief Program Officer and General Counsel for American Promise.
I'm Lou Larini, and I'm pleased to welcome Brian Boyle, Chief Program Officer and General Counsel for American Promise, an organization dedicated to bringing together Americans from across political parties to pass and ratify the 4R Freedom Amendment to secure elections and government for we the people, and not big money, not corporations, not unions, not shadowy super PACs and special interests. Hey, thanks for making time for us today, Brian. How you doing?
Good. Thank you, Lou, and it's great to have a chance to kind of share a little bit more about our work with your listeners.
Yeah. You know, I just, you know, briefly tell me a little bit about how you came to work with American Promise. You know, I know you were there in Massachusetts for a while, I guess, before you joined them.
Yeah, so happy to share a little bit about that. So I had went to law school. I worked in a law firm for a number of years. And then actually after my son was born in 2018, I don't know, I think there's something about becoming a new parent. Your aperture widens and you start to think about the future a bit more. And I was really getting concerned about what felt like a growing disconnect between the powers that were being exercised over everyday Americans versus our role in actually shaping rules and regulations and policy. And it felt like one of the root causes of this gap between where the people were and maybe where our government was functioning was the role of money in our politics. And it felt like a very root cause thing for me to potentially get involved in as a volunteer. And so that's what I did. I had learned about American Promise and its sole focus on an amendment to address the issue of money in politics. And I reached out to one of the co-founders and said, I'd love to volunteer. And that's how it started. And then one of the things I quickly realized was how unique the organization was in the way that it operates in the American political ecosystem, because it has been serious from the get-go about a constitutional amendment, and that's the only thing American Promise works on. And what that means is, you know, an amendment isn't one party by itself. It has to be supermajorities. It has to be people from both sides of the aisle. And so the organization has always operated in a way where Republicans, Democrats, and everyone in between is welcome to be part of the work. And that requires a certain focus and a certain discipline, and it really appealed to me and actually gave me hope at a time when I was really feeling nervous about the future, especially for my kid.
Yeah, geez, that's a great story. You know, since, of course, Citizens United, which just about anybody who follows politics knows, you know, kind of changed the rules about campaign financing by giving corporations and others the same speech rights as individual persons, you know, and more or less virtually, you know, put no limits on the amount of money they could raise or give to a candidate. You know, even to the casual observer, you could see that that's corrupting the system. Now, how will the 4R Freedom Amendment solve that problem?
Thank you for that question. And if I could, can I just go back a little bit further in time than Citizens United? Because I think that's certainly the case that most people have heard of, because it was, you know, decided only in 2010. But there's sort of the grandfather of all money in politics cases is a case called Buckley versus Valeo. which was decided actually in 1976, so 50 years ago this year. And that case, the Buckley case, was the case that set us down the path that we've been on for the past five decades, because that was the time where the Supreme Court, for the first time ever, basically said, we are going to start to treat limits and regulations of money in politics as if they were regulations of speech itself. And so that's where this sort of one-to-one equivalence between money and speech started to take hold of the judiciary. And then that line of cases is what brought us to Citizens United in 2010. And the reason I wanted to make sure your listeners had that historical context is because when you ask the question about what would the For Our Freedom Amendment do, our target, so to speak, actually is Buckley versus Valeo, in the sense that we want to rewind the clock to the moment before Buckley was decided, and in our view, return to sort of the system that the founders envisioned when they might have thought about, well, who actually gets to decide things about whether we're going to regulate money in elections? Never in a million years would the founders have thought, oh, that's going to be a job for judges and the Supreme Court. They would have thought this is a job for the states and for Congress and for the American people through that sort of representative process. So what the amendment would do is to basically tell the Supreme Court, you took a wrong turn 50 years ago. You've become the nation's chief campaign finance policymakers. That role actually should be held by primarily the states and Congress. And so the amendment would give that power back to the states and Congress. And then one thing I also think is probably important for your listeners to understand about our approach is the amendment itself would not try to set any limits. And I think there's a really important reason why it doesn't do that. The best sort of constitutional language is answering questions like, well, who gets to decide? It doesn't actually set a policy, right? Most text in the Constitution doesn't say you're going to have these limits. It just says who's going to decide what the limits are. And we focus on Congress and the states because that's where the American people can have some influence. Some states may say, you know what, we don't have such a problem with all the big money flowing into our elections. And they may pass policies based on that policy preference, but other states and the people in those states may have different views. And this amendment allows for some differences across states and how they approach this issue. But the key thing is it gets the courts out of the business of deciding how to regulate money in politics.
Yeah, because I mean, essentially, yes, and you're absolutely right. I did know about that Buckley case, but you know, I started off with Citizens United, just like what you said, because I know my listeners are more aware of that, and that's when it really started to get to be really obvious, because didn't Citizens United, I mean, one of the little sort of, I guess, side parts of it is it made it almost impossible, you know, like to regulate elections or you know, election financing, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the key thing. So the key thing that Citizens United did was, it basically gave birth to what we now know as super PACs. And if I could, I just try to explain this a little bit to listeners, because I think it's
please do. Yeah.
So you might be sitting at home or on your computer and you see an ad pop up, and the ad is talking about a candidate or maybe even a couple candidates, and you would think it's like, oh, this is an ad paid for by a campaign because it's either boosting a candidate or maybe attacking a candidate. But then when you get to the end, and you might see something like, this ad paid for by, you know, Floridians for good government. And then you're like, well, who's that? You try to figure it out. Floridians for good government might be super PAC. And that super PAC might be getting its money from all sorts of people all over the country and not having to, well, a couple things, not even having to disclose ultimately where the money is coming from, but also not being subject to any limits on how much it can raise and how much it can spend. because Citizens United basically said, if you're an entity, a corporation, a nonprofit, anything, if you're somebody that's spending, quote, independent of the campaign, you can have no limits on what you spend. And that's true of corporations and artificial entities. So the principles from Citizens United created these super PACs, which have now, in many cases, become even bigger spenders in elections than campaigns themselves, than political parties themselves. And sometimes you might hear, you know, in the newspaper, oh, this billionaire is supporting that candidate. The way they are supporting the candidate, most likely, is by creating a super PAC and then spending unlimited amounts of money through the super PAC.
Yeah, that's right. And there are, like, you know, sort of little rules that they found it really easy to get around, you know, I guess, you know, to allow that sort of unlimited spending, because aren't there still limits on what, like, an individual can give to a campaign? I forget exactly what the number is, but it's like thousands, I guess. You know, but
So that kind of goes back to that 1976 decision, because what the Supreme Court did was they said, hey, listen, we think when money is being spent in campaigns, we're going to treat it like it's a First Amendment issue, and we're going to strike down most laws that set limits, with one small exception, and it's the one that you just named, Lou, which is if there's a law that tries to set a limit on how much an individual can give directly to a candidate, some limits on that are permissible. But if you're a billionaire and you're subject to a $5,000 limit to a candidate, you have a way around now, which is, well, I'm just going to create a super PAC to spend money for that candidate. And the Supreme Court has said, I, the billionaire, have a First Amendment right to spend unlimited amounts through my super PAC. And I think that's the part that our amendment is really addressing. We're saying, listen, when the First Amendment was ratified in the, you know, late 1700s, nobody thought that what that First Amendment was doing was saying, oh, billionaires will one day be able to spend unlimited amounts of money to influence American elections, or even to a certain degree foreign entities that have been spending hundreds of millions of dollars in American elections. So that's not what the First Amendment originally meant. It got warped by the Supreme Court 50 years ago, and that's what the amendment tries to correct.
Okay. I just want to remind listeners just tuning in, this is WSLRLP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I'm speaking with Brian Boyle, who is Chief Program Officer and General Counsel for American Promise. Okay, all right, we've pretty much set out the problem, the issue, you know, and the solution proposed is a constitutional amendment, which I'm sure sounds very daunting to a lot of people, but you guys point out that we may be in an era of an amendment era is upon us. Please explain that, and when this has happened in history, and why we should maybe be a little more confident that this might happen.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk a little bit about that, and you're definitely right when you're at a party and somebody asks what you do and you say, oh, I work on mobilizing support for an amendment to the U.S. Constitution, you get a couple reactions. One is, oh, my gosh, that sounds amazing. And then number two is, but, like, can that actually happen? So I'm here to tell your listeners not only can it happen, it is happening. And this idea of an amendment era, I think, is really important historical context, because first of all, when the Constitution was originally ratified, they specifically included the amendment process because they knew that the American people would have reasons to update, fix, deal with unanticipated problems. So they included that amendment tool as a way to make sure that the Constitution could always still belong to the American people. And It's not a tool that you should use lightly. It does have supermajority requirements, so it's not easy. But the American people, a number of times over history, have come together, and oftentimes it will be in these eras where you'll do maybe a few amendments at a time because the pressure in the system has built up to a point where actually the only and the best way to address it is through the amendment process. I think the clearest example of this are the trio of amendments that were passed after the Civil War. So obviously those were at a time when the country was extremely divided, but the way through that division was actually in part the amendment process. And then there was another sort of amendment era shortly, it was right around the turn of the 20th century when people were starting to see that concentrated power was starting to build up, and they were a bit worried about that. So you saw some structural amendments, for example, the amendment that allowed for direct election of senators and the amendment that allowed for women to vote, and then an amendment that actually addressed a specific Supreme Court decision around the power to tax. So we've done it in the past. We tend to do it at times when the political situation feels fraught and maybe even polarized to a point where people can't actually imagine working together. What you then find, though, is the amendment process forces you to find those principles, those sort of least common denominator things that everybody agrees on, and that's how you move forward. And we think the For Our Freedom Amendment is actually turning out to be one of those things that there is wide public support and cross-partisan support for.
Yeah, it is true, and I know on your site, I mean, you quote some you know, polls by Pew and others, you know, that show, you know, remarkable support for this among the American people across all partisan lines, you know, independents, Republicans, Democrats, everybody. This seems to be one thing that they agree on. How close are we? I know that there are, I guess, 25 states that have already, voted on a resolution to send to Congress to say that they're in favor of this change. How many more do they need, and how's that process going?
Yeah, we're actually really excited that we just recently hit that 25-state milestone when Idaho became the 25th state to pass one of these resolutions. So let me say a little bit about what these resolutions do. So these resolutions are passed by state legislatures. So both the Senate and the House at the state level votes and says, hey, Congress, we are ready for an amendment that addresses the role of money in our elections. And we want you to take this seriously and propose an amendment that we could then ratify. So these resolutions aren't technically part of the formal amendment process, but they are and historically have been a way to show to Congress, hey, not only is the public sort of opinion supportive of this idea, but there's actual political interest back home from the members of your own party, right? So, so just for example, if the Oklahoma legislature unanimously passed a resolution, which they did a couple of months ago, you take that and then you bring it to the congressional delegation for Oklahoma and show them and say, look, these are names that you recognize. These are the people back home that support this. So that's a lot of the work that American Promise is doing. We want to obviously get more states on record with these resolutions, although we feel that having 25 states is a really great sign of the momentum, the building momentum. But a lot of what we're also doing is spending time on Capitol Hill so that members of Congress are aware of the level of support back home and are seeing the state legislators already taking steps. So the next steps from here are, at least from American Promise's perspective, we're going to continue to try to support states in passing these resolutions. We are going to continue talking with members of Congress. And as you know, like there's an election coming up, so that means there could be lots of new members of Congress. We have to educate them about the amendment. And then you need two-thirds of Congress to propose the actual text. And once that happens, it would go back to the states for ratification. So it's not going to happen tomorrow, but we think in the next couple of years, there's a real shot that this thing gets proposed and sent back to the states for ratification, just because the momentum and the interest in this amendment solution seems to be accelerating.
Yeah, I'm curious, do these resolutions submitted to Congress, is there anything binding about them when they hit a certain level? You know, is Congress obliged to, take up the issue and write text and vote on a constitutional amendment, or is this just kind of a political thing where they're just showing to their congressional delegation that you better do something about this because the people are really into it and you may not get elected next time if we tell them that you let it go. I mean,
that's an excellent question, and the answer is a little bit of both. So the resolutions that that we are supporting, on the one hand, they are not they're not legally binding in the sense that they wouldn't trigger what some of your listeners might have heard of as a convention of states, which is like a separate legal process. So they wouldn't trigger that, but to your point about are they sort of politically meaningful, they are politically meaningful because when members of Congress see, oh, wow, the number of states that have passed these resolutions is actually getting quite close to the number of states that would be needed to call a convention, that that sends a signal. And in fact, in the past, Congress has been moved to propose an amendment when they saw that enough states were already mobilizing that they started to get afraid that a convention might be called instead. So it's interesting how these dynamics play off of one another, but our strategy, we're focused on getting Congress to propose the language rather than having a convention of states be called to propose an amendment.
Okay, yeah, I know another, and this is just, an interesting thing that jumped out at me, aspect of the for our freedom amendment is that, it would make it hard for the Supreme Court, to meddle in elections, again. So there wouldn't be another one. You wouldn't have to have another amendment to correct something else the Supreme Court did, right?
Yeah, and thank you for saying that about the text that we proposed. And that actually came from the input of not just legal scholars, but Americans all over the country. We did a project a number of years ago where we were asking folks, what should this amendment try to do? And one of the things we heard over and over again was the amendment should make it really clear to the Supreme Court that we want them to back down in this area, that, when they've gotten involved, particularly in money and politics questions, they've tended to make things worse from the perspective of the American people. So while of course Congress will probably look at the language and have some ideas and there'll be hearings and all that, we think that the draft in our Freedom Amendment really does send a clear signal that the Supreme Court should not meddle in this area any longer.
Okay, great. Brian, I just want to remind people, I'm speaking with Brian Boyle, from American Promise. And one last question, what can citizens do to help move this along?
Oh, I love that question because there's so many things people can do. I've got to mention, come visit our website, AmericanPromise.net. And the reason I say that is if you're interested in volunteering or getting more deeply involved, you can sign up. And we have a whole process where there are different things you can do. Sometimes, depending on where you live, there might be a specific thing that we're working on. But no matter where you are in the country, one of our biggest programs is a letter to the editor program, because to your question earlier about, hey, constitutional amendment, that's kind of hard. you're absolutely right that there's kind of this general skepticism about our ability to even use the amendment process anymore. But the more people are writing into their newspapers, talking to their neighbors, and getting those things published in their local news media, it starts to kind of change the conversation, and people say, oh, actually, this amendment stuff is viable, right? They're hearing about it more. So I'd say the first thing that people can do is to just not dismiss the idea of a constitutional amendment and to talk to their friends and neighbors about why it's such an important tool that we still have. And then if you are interested specifically in our work, then yes, please sign up to volunteer and learn more. And we have a whole team that can do some onboarding and education. So would welcome anybody. And again, it truly, like, anyone from any background, any political ideology, where we on our staff, on our board, we have Republicans, Democrats, and everything in between. So we really cultivate an environment where we don't care what letter is after your name or what color hat you wear. We just are united as patriots in the belief that people should ultimately shape the course of our elections and not money.
Sounds good, Brian. Thank you very much for making time for us today. You have a good
Thanks
day.
So much, Lou. You too.
Great. Bye.
President Donald Trump seems to be a fan of Frank Sinatra. However, the legendary singer's eldest daughter, Nancy Sinatra, is no fan of his. The These Boots Are Made for Walking singer took notice of Trump posting a video on Truth Social of her late father singing his hit song, My Way. This is a sacrilege, Sinatra, who is 85, said in an X post on April 19th regarding Trump's use of her father's performance. When another ex-user asked Sinatra if there was something she could do, she replied, unfortunately, no. The only people who can do something are the publishers. Sinatra's feelings seemingly did not change days later, reposting another user's post regarding the issue. This is just sickening. Frank Sinatra would never have allowed that monster in the White House to use his music or put his lyrics in his mouth. Sinatra was a man of honor, a man who never had to lie about who he truly was, because he was the greatest. Trump is a loser. It is unclear why Trump posted the clip of Frank Sinatra, as he did not write a caption or give any further context. Trump's post comes amid ongoing negotiations with Iran to end the war that began nearly 2 months ago. Trump and the Iranian government agreed to a temporary two-week ceasefire on April 8th following the ongoing tensions and the deaths of 13 military service members. These negotiations seem to be in limbo as Trump, in a Truth Social post on Sunday, wrote, "We're offering a very fair and reasonable deal and hope they take it, because if they don't, the United States is going to knock out every single power plant and every single bridge in Iran." Trump concluded his post writing, "No more Mr. Nice Guy." While Sinatra's rendition of My Way has become renowned, even receiving a Best Contemporary Vocal Performance nomination at the 12th Grammy Awards in 1970, he is not the song's originator. The original version, My Way, is a French song, Comme d'habitude, which was previously performed and co-composed by Jacques Revaux. Paul Anka, a Canadian-American singer and songwriter, was also known for writing She's a Lady, wrote the English-language version of My Way in 1969. Nancy Sinatra wrote Truth in April 19th, ex-post, in response to another user who said Anka wrote the English lyrics to the music of a 1967 French song, which was composed by Jacques Rivera, with the lyrics by Claude Francois and Gilles Thibault. Anka's lyrics are entirely different from the original French. Frank Sinatra would release My Way in early 1969 Ankenas 84, said in a Facebook post that he wrote the lyrics for Sinatra when he was just 25 years old. You're listening to WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPV, LP 100.